Today's podcast is sponsored by RadRx, your source for quality online education for interventional and diagnostic radiology coding, taught by subject matter expert Stacy Buck. For more information and testimonials, visit RadRx.com. Struggling to learn interventional radiology coding? If so, RadRx has the perfect solution for you. Cracking the IR Code, Mastering Interventional Radiology and Cardiology online training program. In this program, interventional radiology coding expert Stacy Buck breaks down the complexities of interventional radiology coding in easy-to-understand terms so you can grasp this complex specialty. Through her course, Stacy has assisted many coders with little or no interventional radiology coding experience in successfully passing the CIRC exam on the first attempt. For additional information and testimonials, visit RadRx.com. Welcome to Who Cares What Stacy Says, a podcast providing insights and advice on how to take your medical coding career to the next level. And now, here's your host, Stacy Buck.
Welcome to another episode of Who Cares What Stacy Says. I am your host, Stacy Buck. I am so excited to have my friend and colleague, Christine Hall, on today's podcast. Christine is president and senior consultant at Sterling Global Solutions. She is certified in healthcare compliance, a CHC. She is a certified professional coder, CPC, a certified professional biller, CPB, a certified professional medical auditor, CPMA, a certified risk coder, CRC, and a certified AAPC instructor. With over 30 years of health administration management experience, Christine is a national public speaker and educator specializing in compliance, ethics and regulatory affairs, accounts receivable, medical coding, credentialing, and practice management. She is well known in the industry as a subject matter expert in risk adjustment, telehealth, reimbursement, and compliance. Because we had such great discussions and lots of fun while recording, our conversation lasted for about 3 hours. Wow. So when I was going through the editing process, I had such a hard time deciding what to cut out, so I decided to edit our conversation into 3 separate episodes. In part 1, which you'll hear today, we discuss Christine's journey into medical coding. We reminisce about how far technology has come since we both started working in the field 30 years ago. And we speculate how artificial intelligence will change patient care. And we wrap up with Christine explaining HCC coding and how to find jobs in this growing specialty. Then, 2 weeks from now, on November 16th, mark your calendars because I will be releasing part 2, which is an absolutely don't miss episode because it's all about how to get paid. We begin with Christine's personal story about taking a step back in her career, leading her to find her angel, and then taking a big step forward. We also discuss strategies to increase your salary in your current position and provide advice for negotiating a salary when interviewing for a new position. And we also examine the concept of pay transparency and discuss some of the differences between men and women when it comes to selling themselves to employers. So again, don't miss the next episode on November 16th called Show Me the Money. You'll definitely want to tune in. And then on November 30th, I will release part 3, where we discuss the importance of having a compliance plan and conducting audits, but then we get a bit silly and things kind of go off the rails. And now, here's part 1 of my interview with Christine Hall. Enjoy. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Who Cares What Stacy Says. I am your host, Stacy Buck, and today I am thrilled to have my friend and colleague, Christine Hall, with me. I enjoyed the last episode of my podcast so much with Tony L. Holmes and doing that first interview. I honestly think that all of my podcast episodes are going to be interview based because it's just so much more interesting and entertaining when I can interact with others. So, Christine, thank you so much for being a part of the podcast today. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Stacy. It's a pleasure to be here with you. I love all of your podcasts, and I can't wait to see what we uncover today about this wonderful industry we're in.
Thank you so much. So before we get started, I want to give people a little bit of our personal backstory and how we came to be. So it was probably, I think it was before COVID lockdown, I believe. That was when I reached out to you the first time. So we're going back to like first quarter of 2020. And we had been connected on LinkedIn. And when I saw, I'm like, you know what? She's local. I would love to connect with another local consultant and kind of network and, you know, pick her brain and get to know her. And so I reached out to Christine to meet for lunch. And then the COVID lockdown happened. So we ended up postponing that lunch meeting. And then when things started to open up again, I think it was like in May, it was May or June of 2020 was when we met for that first lunch. And, you know, we clicked during that lunch and we had great conversation, but then we actually did not see each other again for a whole entire year. And it was a year later, I said to myself, I need to reach out to Christine. We need to go have lunch again and, you know, have, you know, some more discussions, you know, over some things. And so long story short, I'm just going to let people know how this kind of evolved. So this year when we start, we've been meeting monthly now. This has been our goal that we meet like monthly this year since we reconnected. And so we had met for lunch. This is now earlier in the year. And we met for lunch at noon and we ended up leaving the restaurant at 6 p.m. We actually sat there until dinner time. Now we were sitting outside on the patio and the restaurant wasn't really busy, so they kind of left us alone. And then we had another lunch where we met up again. We met at noon and then we end up parting ways about 6 or 6:30. So we started joking around that we should just plan for lunch and dinner the next time that we meet up. And so what we did the following time when we met at noon again. We were still talking about 7:30. And Christine's like, hey, do you want to go get some dinner? So we went out for dinner and we actually ended up hanging out until midnight that night. So from noon until midnight. And then last time we were together, we broke our record. We met at noon and we hung out until 1 o'clock in the morning. So we have our jokes about having our long dinners. and I know last time when we met up, her husband was joking with her, oh, is this meeting going to turn into a sleepover? Like it seems that every time you guys get together, you always hang out longer. So now we joke about getting together for our monthly dinners. And so I've really enjoyed you know, getting to know Christine. You know, I consider her a friend now, not just, you know, a colleague or a business acquaintance. What started out as, you know, business networking has turned into a friendship. And I'm so thankful for that because we always have so much fun when we're together. So Christine, I don't know if you want to give your take on how it's evolved or share some of your thoughts, but it's really been a great time over this past year.
It really has, Stacey. I've enjoyed hanging out with you. And again, I consider you a friend too, really, more than a colleague. I think you have a brilliant mind. You are the IR goddess. But as a friend, you're amazing. And we have such similar stories. And yes, we started to find out that we have more things in common than we really knew. We have people in common. We have places in common. So, yes. Stacey, it's been so much fun. I think we have another dinner coming up soon. And maybe next week we're going to grab some more people in for our dinners. So I'm super excited.
Definitely. We definitely need to expand our group of like loud and funny. Like we're both loud and funny. And so we have found other people. We know of at least one other person who's loud and funny who wants to be part of our group. So we may build a little club and go forward. So I'm so happy to have you here on the podcast. And I have a feeling that we could probably set the record for like the world's longest podcast. Like, is there like a Guinness Book of World Records like official thing for that? Because I believe we could definitely hands down like blow that away if it did existed, because I'm sure we could talk just for days and weeks if we needed to.
Well, challenge accepted. Let's do this.
Okay. So let's go ahead and get started with our interview with Christine. So Christine, for, you know, those listeners who are not familiar with you and who you are and what you do, tell us a little bit about your current occupation.
Well, currently I am a jack of all trades, let's just say. So I have a consulting firm. We specialize in coding and compliance. And we also do some billing intervention. We do a lot of education. And I think that's something that we just, you can't know it all. How are you going to know it all? It's just constantly. So yes, I spend a lot of time learning and gathering information and sharing it. I love to share the information that I've learned with people in the industry. I'm also teaching for the AAPC right now. They have a virtual instructor-led training. So I've been able to join that. So I'm teaching billing and coding this year. And I'm also the chairwoman for the Billing Advisory Committee. I'm on my local AAPC chapter. I'm an officer with them. And hopefully over the next year, I'm going to start doing some more things with FHIMA. So yeah, a little busy.
Awesome. Yeah, I am slowly pulling you into FHIMA. You will be speaking at the FHIMA all-day virtual coding event in January. So thank you very much for agreeing to do that. We're always trying to find fresh, new speakers because we tend to recycle a lot of the same people and we have some great ones, but it's nice to bring in some new people. So I'm glad that you agreed to help us with that. So one question I always like to ask professionals, whether it's a casual meeting, formal meeting, an interview like this, what made you choose the health information management profession or what made you choose the coding profession? I find that everybody I talk to, those of us who, especially who are older, I should say, younger people, this may be a little bit different. Well, you and I, this is the thing. When I was reading your bio and I'm like, you have 30 years of experience. I'm like, you're old like me because I'll be entering your 30th year like next year. So we're like two like old timers here, you know, talking to people. But I find it with old timers like us that we didn't plan to go into this field. We just kind of somehow fell into it or stumbled into it. So if you could share a little bit of your story, that would be great.
Sure, sure. So I've always had an entrepreneur heart. I've always worked. I don't remember. I think my mother said I was probably 7 or 8, and I used to draw pictures and go knocking on people's doors if they wanted to buy my pictures so I could get candy bars and things like that. So work was just always came easy to me. When I became a teenager, my father said, "Do you want to drive a car?" Yeah, I want to drive a car. Who doesn't want to drive a car? I'm 16. I need to run around. He said, "You need a job." So he kind of tossed the phone book over to me and he said, here's a lot of opportunities. Go find a job. And the phone book landed and it opened up to an advertisement for my local hospital. So I didn't need much pushing after that. I ran to the hospital. They had a position open in the billing office and I got it. I understood it. It was, oh, gee whiz. Sorry about this, Stacy. I have my, oh my goodness.
The little doggy.
Yes, my attack chihuahua, who's all of 3.5 pounds, is going after something, or probably the Amazon guy who's coming to my house for the third time today. Yeah, all right, Cujo. Idle down there, buddy. So yeah, I went into the business office and they had a position open for an assistant cashier. And what that meant at the time was I had a giant pegboard that I would open up all the checks that came into the business office. And I had to like manually write each person's, from the explanation of benefits, each person's payment. So it was a long pegboard sheet. And from there, it would go over to the input department. And the input department would put it in these computers that were about the size of my living room. So that worked out well. From then, I went to another hospital, worked in their billing office, and kept going. I just fit into the industry. Like, I understood it. I got it, the business of medicine. And so I have to definitely give my dad props for making the suggestion to go find a job and then thanking God that it opened at that page and it was a calling for me. So whether you want to say dad intervention, divine intervention, or just good old, understanding the concept kind of thing, this is what I was meant to do.
Yeah, I definitely believe in the divine intervention because, I've shared my story in past podcast episodes. So I won't go into that again, but it is one of those things. It was just taking small steps and it was, through a temp job that I ended up in this industry and I never planned to do it. I never knew it existed. And it's an industry that's been so good to me and I've had so much success in it. And I'm so glad that my life took this path and took this direction that it did. Now, when you were talking and you're telling your story, this goes back to us being old timers. I'm thinking, she mentioned a pegboard. There are people who are going to be listening to this podcast who are going to have no idea what a pegboard is.
I know.
That is like so ancient. Now, in high school, when I was learning accounting and all that, they talked about the pegboard. We weren't using pegboards in high school, but they talked about the pegboard. So I understand the concept of pegboard. And it also, when you said that about the pegboard, and I was thinking, people aren't going to know what that is. I remember this was several years ago. I was having a meeting with a group of individuals. This was for the local professional association. And we had a group of people that were a little bit older. And then we had a younger, newer professional. So we're talking 20-year age gap here between you know, myself and her. And we were having discussions in this meeting and she was our treasurer. And I made the comment, I'm like, blah, blah, and you'll need to cut a check. And I kept talking and she's sitting there looking puzzled. And I said, are you okay? Do you have a question? And she said, what does cut a check mean? And I started laughing because the younger generation, they don't deal with checks like we have dealt with checks. Now she's aware of what a check is. She was not familiar with that term, cut a check. And that's something that's been said for years and years and years in business. You tell somebody, hey, cut a check for this, cut a check for that. So the generational differences are kind of funny. Now that I'm at the older end of that, it's different. It's funny to see it, the younger people and how they respond to some of the things old folks like us say, versus when I was younger, I was laughing at like the older people for some of the things that they would say. So it's kind of shifted and I'm laughing for.
I have a funny story to piggyback off of that story. So I do a lot with telehealth, and I did telehealth way before telehealth was cool. So I was part of the Southeastern Resource Telehealth Center and those meetings and trying to promote more and more telehealth. So I had a presentation that I needed to do at one of the medical societies, and I sat my family down and I said, okay, let me practice on you guys because, you know, this is a new topic and I want to make sure I present it correctly. And I don't do that anymore. But back in the beginning when I was talking, I used to do that with my family from time to time and they indulge me. So I'm sitting there explaining telehealth and you know, how we have an originating site and a destination site and asynchronous and synchronous. And my youngest son, who's 23 now, but at the time, I think he was like maybe 18 or something like that. And he throws his hand up and he goes, Mom, that's not how telehealth works. Oh, really? Please enlighten me, son. And he goes, no. I do telehealth all the time. Like my doctor's on my phone. There's an app for the doctor. And you click the app. It's $55. And you can't do it on the beach. I tried to, but they made me go sit in my car in the parking lot. And you just tell them what's wrong. And they call a prescription and you can pick it up on your way home from the beach. Oh, yeah. Things have really changed. So yes. That's just goes to show you how the younger generation even does healthcare differently than, you know, we're used to going and sitting in an office for 2 hours while we wait to be roomed and right. Then have 30 seconds with our providers.
That's about what it feels like. I mean, seriously. Yeah.
As a patient, that's what it feels like. But yeah, the younger generation, they just do things so differently than what we've been accustomed to. I do hope telehealth moves in that direction, that we open up some more availability for telehealth even after the public health emergency. But that was a funny story about how the young and the old perceive things differently.
Yeah, absolutely about telehealth. Like I'm excited like about that. There were so many times over the years I would think to myself, if I could just get on the phone with my physician for 5 minutes, that's all that I need to discuss this issue or this concern. Then if you need to see me, I will come see you. I'm a very big proponent of that for minor issues because you hesitate to go see the doctor because there's a cost involved. And it's not just so much the cost for me. It's not paying for the office visit. It's the time to go to the office, sit and wait because nobody's ever on time with appointments. So you sit potentially for 45 minutes to see the doctor for 5 minutes. And so that's part of that. So I'm excited to see where telehealth goes, even as an old timer. Now, again, I think this is a generational shift. I know that patients who are my parents' age, they are not a fan of the telehealth concept. They are so accustomed to that face-to-face meeting with the physicians. Whereas I feel like our generation, we're open to that. I mean, when we think about it in technology, you know, not just in healthcare, but just in the world, in life in general, our generation is the first generation who saw technology adopted on a widespread basis. So we have really seen such an evolution in our lifetime. Now, it amazes me how the younger whippersnappers can pick up anything and figure it out like so effortlessly. And they're like ahead of us. But I still feel like even, you know, those of us who were born in the, you know, the early 70s there, we've been that generation who has been able to see that evolution in technology, which has been absolutely amazing.
Yeah. So like I said, the computer back in 1980 something was the size of my living room. Now, I mean, look at what we do with our smartphones. I'm able to connect anywhere in the world.
Yes, I can remember. So technology. So my dad, okay, this was in the 1980s. He had what a 1980s laptop would have been. And it was a big metal box, like a ridiculous metal box. And it had like the screen on it with like the green, you know, cursor and things like that, whatever that old technology was. And the keyboard would flip up to cover the screen and it would like lock on there. I think it was like a K Pro 2000 or something. And I used to play computer games on that. And that thing was ridiculously heavy. It was this giant box. And that was really the first version of what a laptop would look like. And so it does make me laugh because we've gone from those monstrosities, or even you probably remember the first car phones, that those huge boxes that sat in a console and it cost you $1,000 to make a local call and something like that. And now we have all of these functions in the palm of our hand, which is truly amazing. I think it is such an exciting time to be alive, especially as an entrepreneur. You probably agree with this, because we have so many opportunities to help people on a larger scale and make a good living at the same time because of technology. I wouldn't be doing as well as I'm doing if it wasn't for technology.
I think you mentioned that in your first podcast was the technology and how if we'd had these things. The funny thing is I was on vacation last week in the mountains of West Virginia. Like really, we were traveling on the Hatfield and McCoy trails.
Nice.
And so we were in the middle of nowhere and I taught 2 virtual classes from the backseat of my husband's truck, right? So talk about technology, right? I was all over the country being able to continue to teach students and didn't miss a beat in the middle of the mountains. So yeah, technology is incredible.
Yeah, we have the ability to work from anywhere. You know, I was on vacation the week before you were, and for the most part, I was off. I can't totally be 100% off, you know, when you're a business owner, but I don't complain about it because most weeks, people know I've talked about this, I work part-time hours most normal weeks. So when I go on vacation, I think I put in about 3 hours, maybe when I was gone. There are just certain things I can't get away from that I have to attend to, where other things can wait until I get back. And so it's such a blessing to be able to work from anywhere, you know, and take care of things when they need to be taken care of. And again, it makes me laugh, you know, back in the day when I first started in the profession, you probably might remember this, where you would access LCDs through what they called that bulletin board system. Mm-hmm. And it was that weird dial-up modem. And that's how we would access, you know, LCDs. And so I think about things like that with the internet just making our lives so much easier than how we used to do things. Even in the 90s, we're talking, you know, dial-up in the 90s. We didn't start probably using internet in the workplace until, I'm trying to think, maybe like around, I don't remember using the internet in the workplace until I changed jobs around 2000. It wasn't, you didn't even have access to it. You might have an intranet within your company, but you didn't have access to anything externally at an employer till, at least for me, till about the year 2000.
Yep. That's about right. We had the intranet within the organizations and the hospitals and that I worked for, but the internet, again, not till, well, no, I think it was late 90s for me because I had a billing company and we sent everything electronically, but it was data files. Like you had to create your batch and then you sent the batch out for that moment electronically. Otherwise, everything was intranet, you know, within the practice there. So it made things pretty difficult. Now everything's on the cloud. You log in from anywhere. Right. It's really easy. I remember we had Log Me In was a software that we had. I think they still use it today, but back then that was the only way that you could connect from one area to another. I was connecting from my office, my brick and mortar office, to my home at night to finish work. And that was what I was using until somebody called, right? And then it disconnected your internet.
Yes.
And right, you remember that? You're like, dang.
I remember.
Yes, that
You have to block that call waiting. You have right. to. You gotta, do that.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, absolutely. So things totally have changed for us. It's incredible.
Yeah. All of those challenges we had in our younger years. Oh my gosh. Kids today just don't know the trials that we suffered along the way.
I think I just heard your parents come out of your mouth, Stacey. I think that's
It's funny. The older you get, the more you sound like your parents. But I still, with my parents, sometimes I say, oh, stop being so old fashioned. Like, seriously, just stop. And because it's more and more for them as they get older. I don't recognize this world anymore. This is not the world I grew up in. I don't want to use it. My mom does not have a cell phone. She refuses to. She doesn't want a smartphone. Now, I did get her a tablet because she likes to browse online and read news articles and listen to different, you know, things. And you know, that's fine to like watch videos and stuff and listen to what she listens to. But she does not want the smartphone. Like, she has no interest in texting, none of that. And it's funny, when she first got on email, this is a funny story, mm-hmm. where she would email me and she would type the entire email message in the subject line. It would say, Mom, what are you doing? I'm like, you're typing the whole message in the subject line. And then finally, I got her to actually type it into the body of the message. Like,
oh my gosh.
So my dad, he's adopted the smartphone technology. He likes texting, all of that. He'll do that. She's like, I want absolutely no part of it. She's like, I have an old prepaid flip phone for emergencies and that's it. Like, nothing else. And she is going to stick to that. Even with healthcare, like with online portals, the doctor's mm-hmm. office wants her to use the portal. She doesn't want to use the portal. I say, well, you've never asked me to sign up for the portal. Please put me on the portal. Why have you never? We have the same doctor. Why have you never signed me up for the portal? I want the portal. So it's kind of interesting. So anyway, okay. Yeah. So now that we've established that you and I are sufficiently old.
Thanks, Stacey. I didn't feel so old before this, but I guess I'm going to have to embrace it after all.
Oh gosh. Hey, there are still always people that are older than us. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So, technically we would be classified as middle-aged. Let's agree on that.
I am definitely agreeing. I support that decision.
Yes, we are definitely like middle-aged. But I think people that are our age who are middle-aged, we're cooler than we've ever been and we look better than we ever have.
Oh, like, absolutely.
I think that. Like, here's a point to, like, you know, prove that. I'm going to use this example to prove that point. Now, I'm a huge Golden Girls fan. Like, I love the Golden Girls. And I know that's a show that everybody absolutely loves. When I watched the Golden Girls that took place in the 80s, these women were supposed to be around the age of 55. They look more like they're 70 or 75, okay?
Absolutely.
Compared to today's standards, 50, 55-year-olds look nothing like that. Now, they were probably older in real life, but still, oh my goodness, I see women today, I personally know women that are 65 and 70 who mm-hmm. look like they're about 50, like they're 50 to 55. I mean, truly yeah. amazing. So I think we all look better, we're way cooler, totally different.
Absolutely.
People look a lot older back then than what they were. I just feel like they did.
I don't know though, but Stacey, I'll tell you, I'm so young at heart that for a split second when somebody says they're 55, I'm like, oh, that's my mom's friend. No, wait a minute, that's my friend. Oh.
Yes.
So I sometimes it's hard to embrace that and realize, oh, wait a minute. Yeah, I kind of fit in that bracket as well, but.
Yeah, I don't, when, you know, people tell me that I don't look my age, and I love those people who tell me that I don't look my age and that I look 10 years younger, but honestly, I don't feel like my age, like mentally, I can't even wrap my brain around that. I feel like mentally, I'm probably still in my 30s, like mentally, although I'm thankful to have the experience and the wisdom, you know, being now only a few years away from 50. Oh my gosh, I can't wrap my brain around that. That I'm there. There's just so much. It's amazing to me, and we're completely off topic like right now, but okay. I know people other can relate. It's amazing to me that, you know, when you're in your 20s, you think you like have it all together and you know so much. And then fast forward 20 years later, you're like, I was really stupid and I didn't know a damn thing. I have actually lived life and been through some things. And there's a lot of things I know that I would do differently. I'm sure there are things that you would do differently. So that is a good segue into another question. See how I did that? I mean, that was to get us back
so
on track.
So smooth, Stacey. So smooth.
Okay. So if you had to do it all over again, you know, what would you do differently or what advice would you give to your younger self? Specifically, let's try to focus on professionally, because obviously the podcast right. is geared towards professional advice and career advice. So what's something you would do differently in your career?
I think I would work a little harder on that work-life balance. I'm a self-proclaimed workaholic. And if I could go back and talk to my younger self, I would say you have got to schedule time for yourself. You've got to make yourself a priority. You know, business is great and that's wonderful, but you also have to set that tone for yourself. So that's what I would say. Schedule time for yourself and make sure that you have that balance in there of work life that I still haven't mastered, but working on it. Like, I advise myself often about it, but if I could go back and tell my younger self that, I would say, don't work so hard, you know, try to enjoy the little things. Not that I haven't, but, you know, just find that balance early on. You'll appreciate it later on.
Yeah, that's probably what I hear from professionals most frequently, what their challenges are, their struggles, is that work-life balance, because everything's so crazy. Now, there are a lot of advantages of the technology that we have at our fingertips, but the disadvantage of technology is that we are accessible 24/7. And so that can be a real problem. And people feel that they must respond right away when they get an email, when they get a phone call, when they get a text. And it's learning that, no, you don't have to. You control when you respond, how you respond. And that's something that it took me years to kind of build that balance. And now people, when I tell them what my daily schedule is like, or my weekly schedule is like, they tell me, I hate you. And I say, no, look, I've had a lot of people tell me that. I mean, I'm, you know, out golfing one day with a friend of mine, and I pull out my phone and I show him on my phone that I just made $2,000 like online. And he says, I hate you, because he's a salesperson that has to grind it out. And so he needs to be working to be making money. And that's the reaction that I get. But it wasn't always like that for me. I used to be the workaholic. I used to work the 50, 60 hour weeks. Like, I had no personal life whatsoever. It was all work stuff, or it was volunteer stuff with the professional association, whether it be at the regional level, the state level, the national level. And then eventually, you know, people have heard my story that I had health issues, and that really put a hard stop to all of that. And I came out of that and my priorities shifted. And I try to communicate to people, you don't want circumstances to force you to make a change. You want to make the change before you find yourself in the circumstances, because you will be better able to navigate through those circumstances there. What would you say is the most important lesson that you have learned in your career? Gosh, I've learned so many. I'm not going to chime in on this question. I don't plan to. I'm just going to let Christine take this one.
I think that the most important information, or what I've learned most, is that change is inevitable. Is you cannot get stuck in the way that things have been done. This is how we've always done it. That change has to happen. You have to be able to move with that change and learn. Learning always is going to be something in this industry that we have to keep evolving in. So change definitely. I can't tell you how many times I go into a practice and that's the standard answer. Well, this is how we've always done it.
Yes.
Followed up with, this is how we get paid. And I have to go, yes. Oh, no, please don't say that to me. It just breaks my heart into a million pieces. Right. I want to know, what is your thoughts behind it? Tell me why this is how you get paid, or tell me why it is that you do this and that you're not willing to change or see another way of doing things. Because, again, I always start off with, you know, just think about evaluation and management codes. They started in 1992. What were you doing in 1992? Right?
Drinking, a lot of drinking. My right? first semester in college, that's what I was doing.
Right. Change is part of our industry. Change is part of the world. It's what we do. We change, you know. I know that one of my first vehicles was a stick shift, and I learned I didn't want to drive a stick shift, so I bought an automatic. But, you know, again, change. Right. We're going to change always in this industry. So that's one of the biggest things that I have learned is you have to embrace the change. You cannot know absolutely everything.
True. When you think
that you do know everything, then it's time to change. It's time to learn more, because there's no way the way that things in this industry change so much. Think about what happened last year. Last year, we changed the way that we treated patients and saw patients and the way that we billed and the way we had new codes that were coming out every quarter. ICD-10, they rolled out 2 interim notices on coding. So much change happens, and you really have to be accepting of it. If your practice doesn't have a consultant on staff that's providing you with that change information, then you need to be that person that's looking out. And again, that just rolls right back into it. You take the extra effort to know the change, to implement the change, to be strong in your practice, to be that valuable person that they cannot be without, because you bring so much to the table. And eventually it will go into your compensation. It will be something you can factor in, because you become that most important person in the practice.
Yeah, definitely. And now we're living in a time where you can know anything about anything. I mean, Google is your best friend. Or if you want to know, keep up with, you know, coding, new things that are new in coding, compliance and whatnot. It goes back to networking. Network with those people who have expertise in those areas. Get on LinkedIn. There's even groups on Facebook, you know, professional groups there. And, you know, Christine does, you know, free education through her coffee, you know, with Chris. I'm sorry, it's not coffee anymore. It's coding with Christine. You're not allowed to call it coffee anymore. It's coding with Christine. She does that. You know, I'm not doing anything, you know, in that way, but I'm doing
these podcasts are amazing, Stacey. Don't undermine them. We've learned so much from these podcasts.
Well, thank you. But the podcasts are more career advice. So I'm talking about more like that billing and coding kind of advice. Mm-hmm. So you have, you know, coding with Christine and then Tony Elham. So I interviewed for the last episode. Her podcast is focused on all kinds of things, but she does billing and coding. Terry Fletcher is another one, coding and compliance. If you follow, you know, these individuals, Victoria Mull is another one out there. Great information. If you follow all of these individuals on social media, they are giving you the benefit of their knowledge and expertise for free. They are looking for all of this new stuff. They are bringing you this new stuff. You don't even have to go out and do all the digging yourself. It's delivered to you. And then guess what? You don't need to tell your employer that you got the information from Christine. You can look like the rock star who just found the information on your own.
That's why we share that information, is so that you can be the rock star.
Yeah. And then they'll be impressed with your ability to bring them, you know, information. You always want to be ahead of the curve. In the one job I had, it was kind of funny. I worked in a compliance position, and the CEO would come to me, "Hey, Stacey, I need you to take a look at this, or we need to do something about this. What are you going to do about it?" I'm like, "Oh, I'm already aware of it. I took care of it." And I always loved giving that response, that I was always like way ahead. So the majority of the time when he brought something to me that he felt we needed to act on, it was already done, or it was in the process of being done. So it's really just staying in the loop there. So you talked about change in the healthcare industry, and definitely, I mean, I've been in healthcare now since 1992, and just the changes have been amazing. And you know, as again, I'm getting ready to enter my 30th year, which I can't believe that. So what do you feel is the most significant change that has occurred in our industry during your career?
I have to say it has been the technology component. So electronic medical records took us from those horrible paper charts that I couldn't read those handwritings. It's an art to learn how to read handwriting. So the electronic medical record, clearinghouses, being able to submit claims electronically, you're not putting them in an envelope, mailing them out and waiting for those to get adjudicated and sent back to you. Like, we can have claims adjudicated within 48 hours now, and the money's in the bank already. So definitely technology and the technology that we touch every day. So the EMRs, much easier to keep everything in one chart. We're not looking in five different places to try to find that information. They now interface with the practice management software. So there's no entering it into one EMR and then porting it over to a practice management. And so I think those of us that have been in the industry and we did it the hard way, now that we can appreciate all of the technology there that's helping us out to do it a little bit easier. So that's technology is my answer for that.
Yeah, definitely. Technology is the biggest change, and technology will continue to bring the biggest changes. I'm excited to see how artificial intelligence.
I was just going to say that.
Yeah, affects the industry. And Tony and I talked about that a little bit in that podcast episode. You know, it's newer to coding right now, but beyond coding, I'm just interested to see how AI will help in diagnosing patients.
Yeah.
That to me is fascinating, where you can get potentially better patient outcomes because AI can catch things that maybe the human physician wouldn't catch. And so it's just a cool concept where AI, you feed it this like great body of information and all of this knowledge, and then it can process this information and knowledge and then spit something out that now a human is going to look at. You're not taking the human element away. The human is going to use it, but it's a way of collecting all of that knowledge into one place. Like, I think about, this is where I hope we get to. Like, do you remember like those episodes of Jeopardy where they had IBM Watson like on Jeopardy? And so IBM Watson like knew the answers to like all the questions. Like, nobody can beat like IBM like Watson. Like, seriously, any question you can ask, it could spit out the answer. And we have that with Siri, Alexa. We ask it a question, it gives us an answer. So can we get it to the point where with artificial intelligence and diagnosing patients, that can we get there where you're just giving it information, and then based on the information, you can possibly come up with a diagnosis for the patient just by feeding it. It reminds me of one of my favorite shows, The Good Doctor, which was on last night. And like Sean Murphy's thought process, where he stops and he stands there, and then you see all like the medical images going through his mind. It's like he's the data processor and he's taking in all the information, and then boom, he has the diagnosis for the patient, or boom, he has the solution.
I was going to say house.
Surgical procedure. Well, house is a whole nother story.
Right. But if everyone had access, well, no, of course it is. But I mean, the way that they would brainstorm and look at all of the signs and symptoms, differential diagnosis, and process that. I think that's what we're hopefully eventually I want to see it in my career if possible. I would love to be able to have my providers do that. I've heard just off topic, well, not off topic really, but I've heard so many patients say, I had to go to 12 different doctors before somebody found the diagnosis,
or five years
went by, or, you know, years went by, and before we found a diagnosis to what my problems were. And again, I think we talked about this one day at lunch, how even in house, they used to have people go into the home and evaluate the home setting. And I saw that with telehealth this year. I talked to a dermatologist who had been treating a patient for probably, you know, 3 or 4 years for a skin condition, did a telehealth visit last year, and was able to see that outside this lady's window in her front yard, she had this type of tree or bush that she was highly allergic to. And so the mystery solved by being able to have that perspective there of what was going on in her home, that again, hopefully AI will be able to absorb all the information that's out there and diagnose us much quicker, much sooner. We don't have to suffer for it as long as people have.
Yeah, to have something better than like Google, because this is the thing. Now, I know doctors hate Google because patients will get on Google and patients will try to diagnose themselves with Google. And it pisses off doctors when they're dealing with patients like that. I've been that patient. Okay, so I know what it's like to be on the receiving end of that disdain. Doctors don't want you Googling information. And there's a lot of medical doctors who don't want to deal with you concerning alternative medicine and alternative treatments and things of that nature. Again, you get a lot of that information from getting online and researching. And so I feel like if there was a better mechanism for people to go to, because Google basically can make you think you're dying. Like no matter what your problem is, you know, you're dying.
Have you ever looked up gas? Gas could lead to cancer, could lead to death, right? Just because you have gas.
Google just takes you down like a very bad like path. Like I agree. Yeah. It's like not the way to go. But like you, like I love TV shows. Do you remember the show that they used to have called Mystery Diagnosis?
Yes.
I don't know if you ever saw, I loved that show. And it was about these people who had these medical conditions, these mysterious medical conditions. They would go to all these doctors. Sometimes they would suffer for years before they got an answer. They would eventually make it to the one doctor in the whole country that actually dealt with these types of cases. So there's got to be a mechanism for taking patient complaints and symptoms and, you know, diagnostics and throwing it somewhere where AI can then give you a list of possibilities, because let's face it, not your PCP isn't going to know about those obscure, rare things, but can the PCP have a tool where you're looking at the list and then you're going based on probability? Where do we start ruling out first, basically, is like a prioritization of where we should start looking, because doctors look for the most obvious cause.
Right.
And I think you and I talked about this a little bit. I shared with you the detail about my health issues and what I went through. They're looking to treat symptoms. When I was going through that process, everybody wanted to treat a symptom. I'm like, stop talking to me about treating my symptoms. Don't throw meds at me to treat symptoms. Find out what the heck is wrong with me. And I don't think I ever mentioned on my podcast what was like wrong with me. It's not like some great mystery. I just, maybe one day I'll talk about it in depth, because I think it might help people who might be struggling, who might be struggling with health issues that are unexplained. I had mold in my house that made me extremely ill. That was only on the radar of one doctor. And I told Christine why that was. And the only reason it didn't get picked up was because I answered every question with a no on the questionnaire he gave me about mold. So he didn't pick up on it. But yeah, it's very, I've been in that situation as a patient and it is super frustrating. So that excites me more than the coding part. I'm like, that's not exciting. You know, I'm involved in that. I work with software companies and I'm like, that doesn't excite me. It's the diagnostic part of AI that excites me, because I'm seeing it used a lot in radiology diagnostics. Because again, what are you doing with AI? You're feeding in those films, all those films, and you're feeding that information there with, you know, the diagnosis and any of the data that goes with it. And now you have this body. And again, you're looking at numbers, you're looking at statistics, you're looking at probability. They're doing a lot of analysis on COVID patients after the fact. They're scanning, they're taking
post-COVID syndrome,
COVID CTs, and then using AI to analyze those and, you know, glean information from that. So to me, that's just super exciting. And I think in that area of diagnosing patients, again, because I've been in that position and it is so darn frustrating.
Yeah.
And when all the traditional testing is coming up normal and nobody's finding anything wrong with you and they're telling you there's nothing wrong and you're just stressed out and you need to go see a psychiatrist. Like, really? That's not, no. So anyway, one day
I agree. It is very frustrating, very frustrating. And thanks for sharing that story with me, because we had to go and stay the night at a relative's house recently. And within moments of getting there, probably within the first half hour, my husband starts, I have a headache, I can't shake. And then he started having some shortness of breath and he started getting antsy. And we ended up leaving and going and staying in a hotel the second night. And it turns out that family member has a massive amount of mold in the back of their house. They had just closed a door. And my husband was so sensitive to it. And I said, oh my goodness, I just had a talk with Stacy about this. You have mold irritation. You have a mold allergy. You can't be around mold. And so it made the next night we stayed in the hotel and he has no symptoms there. So so many different things.
Yeah, I have to talk about that in a future podcast, just because there are other people, I told you, since that happened to me, there are other people I've come across that had a similar journey and were having all kinds of unexplained issues. And then eventually mold was found in their house. So I think there are a lot of people out there suffering needlessly from a mold issue. And nobody is even thinking about that. It's not on the radar of physicians.
Right. We're in South Florida. I mean, really, we're wet. We have hurricanes. Our houses get infiltrated. If the ants can come in out of the rain, what's to say that the rain's not coming in to create mold in our homes? And
absolutely,
you know, that should be something else. They go and they look at our roofs every 10 years. Why aren't they doing some sort of a mold detector in the walls every 10 years or so?
Yeah. Well, I'm pretty much a human mold detector now. That's like a talent that I have. Like, I can usually figure it out pretty quickly that's an issue. I actually think when I was on vacation, the condo where I was staying, they may have some mold in the AC ducts and vents, I'm thinking, because there were some things going on when I was there. And I've been better since I got back home. So I'm like, that's very interesting. But anyway, again, one day I will share that story. It's not career related, but if it doesn't affect you, it might pertain to somebody that you know, and you might find it helpful.
That was a
turning point in my career. It ended up affecting me professionally. So it was a turning point in my life, everything that I went through.
Well, you know, that's funny that you say that, because that's what I had shared with you. Like, I had had a baby, and that was the turning point in my life, you know, that I chose to go into a different pathway there. So it is, sometimes it is, it's an illness, or it is a death or birth or marriage or, you know, a loss of some sort that really pivots what we're doing in life.
Yeah. Generally, people don't make a huge change or a significant change until they're forced to, for the most part. That's been my observation of human behavior. Some people will take the leap and they'll just go for it, and there's no particular reason. They just make a decision. Other people will think about things. They'll entertain the idea of doing something, but they won't pull the trigger on it until circumstances force them to. And unfortunately, that's the way that we all are. And I got thrown into my own business. I didn't pick the time, you know, when, how, why. There's a lot of things I didn't choose, but they ended up working out. COVID proved that. A lot of people had to pivot during COVID and find, you know, something different to do. I think now, you know, it's the whole workforce issue has been politicized, and I don't want to get into that. But one thing that I think people are neglecting here when they say, well, we have all these job openings and nobody wants to work, I don't think that's true. I think they're oversimplifying the problem. You're always gonna have a segment of the population that doesn't wanna work. That's just human nature, it's a reality. Some people don't. What I think is there are people who were having these jobs, particularly in the food service industry, hospitality industry, who don't want to go back to those jobs, have found other ways to make money, and they're not going back. I think that is a factor that no one talks about. They're trying to blame it on stimulus money and people not wanting to work. And I think that is honestly a very small percentage of what's going on, because stimulus money is not enough to live off of. It's just not. It just isn't for people. At least where we live, it's not. You know that, Christine.
Oh,
stimulus checks are not enough for people to live off of.
So you
adapt, you find another way to make money for yourself. And a lot of people are working for themselves now as a result of COVID. That was the push that they needed to leave the employer behind and go do something entrepreneurial. That has been huge throughout all of this.
Absolutely. I have seen that too. Definitely. And I think there is some sort of a work shortage in certain areas. And I think you hit it hospitality wise, only because we just went on vacation on our journey home from vacation.
I mean, and who wants to deal with the public anyway?
Even with non-COVID,
who wants to deal with the public? Now you add COVID to the mix, you get another risk to deal with.
Well, we couldn't find from West Virginia to Florida, we couldn't find any of the fast food joints that had open dining. Everything was drive-through, and the signs said, due to lack of staff, we can only keep our drive-through open to serve you. And I just thought that was it. Now that you're saying what you said, it makes perfect sense, because our unemployment rate is not, you know, at its all-time low, as you would expect to see with this type of
exactly.
notices. So they've got to be doing something else. And, you know, I told you I'm teaching for the AAPC right now, and I'm doing 3 classes a week, 30 people per class. That's close to 100 people a week. And I'm one of 40 instructors that are teaching these courses. And so people are definitely looking for a different outlet, something different to do. And we have a need. So the healthcare industry has been needing more people for a long time. So this is a kind of a nice thing. I still don't know how I'm going to get my Chick-fil-A on time, but you know, if I have some great colleagues to work with, I'm probably going to get over it a lot quicker.
Yeah. Yeah. People have just been reinventing themselves. I mean, society has changed for better or worse. There are things that will never go back to the way they were before. I know that a lot more people started homeschooling their kids. So because they're homeschooling kids, now they're choosing to do something from home for income. Again, it's not that people aren't working. I think they've changed their work setting, which is the issue. So when I listen to the news and they want to beat that drum about why and like make this political, statistics, I don't think anybody's really digging into all the reasons why. It is a combination of reasons, but I feel right. strongly people have found another way to make a living, to make money without being beholden to, you know, the restaurant owner. That's the biggest industry that obviously I feel like has been hit. Although in our area, I don't feel like we're experiencing those problems. I mean, we're in South Florida. We're the northern part of South yeah. Florida. I don't really see in that industry that there's much of an issue where it was for a while. You go to a restaurant and they say, oh, it's going to be an hour wait. And you're like, but wait, half of your tables are open. Well, sorry, I don't have the cooks in the kitchen to make the food right. and I don't have the staff to serve you the food. And so you're waiting. But that I haven't noticed that to be a problem. I'd say maybe July, August, it still was, but not as much.
It's getting better. Yes, for sure. Yeah. It's getting better.
So yeah. But again, I think people have just found better ways to make money, and I don't blame them. If you're in one of those jobs that's considered a lower wage job, if you found an alternative that pays you the same or more, there's no reason why you would ever go back to that. So those business owners are going to have to be creative and figure out how to restructure their business based on the fact that people don't want those jobs anymore. Yeah. You know, it's just a simple fact there. Okay. So why don't we, I had so many questions I wanted to ask you, but I know we've been talking with a super, super like long time. This actually is probably going to end up, I said, we need a 2-part episode. This is probably going to be a 3-part episode, which is perfectly fine because, hey, I get a third episode like out of a podcast.
Yay!
So that's okay. You know, with me. So we'll try to start steering towards the end, and we'll try to get into some maybe more fun questions. So, but before we get into the fun stuff, one thing that I definitely wanted to ask you about, because this is a hot topic, is about HCC coding. So you are, one of your areas of expertise is HCC coding. And this is an area of coding that you constantly see all these job openings out there. Recruiters are trying daily. You know, I have 100 openings for HCC coders. Send me your resume. We need to fill these positions. So for my listeners who don't know what HCC coding is, can you please explain what that is? And then it seems to be a good fit for newer coders. So how a newer coder that's not as experienced would go about getting into HCC coding?
Sure. Thanks. I love HCC coding. I love everything that has to do with, it's really risk adjusting, and it's value-based reimbursement. So for many, many, many years, we just had traditional fee-for-service. You know, you go to the doctor and it's $100 and that's what the price is, whether he spent 5 minutes with you, whether you're a very sick patient, whether you're not a sick patient, that was it. From the provider's perspective, that was also kind of very difficult. So if you had a patient that had 4 or 5 chronic conditions that you're managing, and you have medications and you have referral sources and diagnostics that you're reviewing, that $100 reimbursement may not really reflect the time and the work that was put into that patient. Right. The other thing is that we were seeing that we had high cost patients versus low cost patients. And why is this patient such a high cost patient? Well, because again, they have 4 and 5 chronic conditions that need to be managed. So very much like the inpatient side of coding and billing and reimbursement, that the inpatient side works on your diagnosis. So if you go into the hospital, what's your diagnosis? That has a certain value to it. And that's how much that's going to get paid. That's kind of ballparking it. But from the other side, that professional service side, especially for the primary care physicians that are juggling these patients on a daily basis with all of these conditions, value-based reimbursement shifts the dollars or the amount of money that is set aside, that per capita per patient to take care of them, and it readjusts it based on their diagnosis or how much care they're going to need by these diagnoses. So we are really shifting from a fee for service where it's $100 to see this patient to, wow, this is a patient who has a lot more conditions that need to be managed. Maybe we should, you know, readjust the money that's set aside to take care of this patient so they're not high cost. So HCC coding are a set of codes. So there's only about 9,000 codes out of our 95,000 diagnoses.
Only 9,000.
You know,
but out of 95,000, you're at less than 10%. So,
right. Yeah. So there are 10% of those conditions out there. And again, I think it's growing more and more, but those conditions out there that have already been proven that they're high cost, diabetes, you know, people have to have their glucose monitors, they have to have their blood work done, their hemoglobin A1Cs, they have medications that they need to take. I mean, I had a friend of mine who was prescribed Trulicity, and that's like $700 a month for Trulicity. Wow. For a diabetic patient. So let's shift those funds over. So I always use the example of my mom. She's 78 years old. Or she's 77. Mom, I hope if you're listening, I got it right.
Oh my God. Don't give her another year.
Oh my gosh. Sorry, Mom. She has no chronic conditions. Hmm. Like at her age, nothing, no high blood pressure, nothing. She goes for her annual wellness visit and maybe a checkup every year. So she doesn't even reach her per capita. Whereas my mother-in-law is a hot train mess. And she has, you know, 12 chronic conditions. She takes a table full of medications. She's got, you know, 16 specialists. She has at least 3 hospitalizations per year. To take care of my mother-in-law is a massive cost. So mm-hmm. we should be able to look at those conditions that my mother-in-law has and then reallocate the funds that we need to treat her. We do that by diagnosis coding. So HCC coding, those 9 or 10,000 codes, maybe there's 10,000 now. Those really shift the funds to those sicker patients to care for those sicker patients to keep that cost contained, that there's enough money to take care of those patients. So from a coding perspective, we need to make sure that the providers are documenting how they're caring for these diagnoses. So they're capturing the diagnosis. And then what's their plan? How are they caring for these patients? And then that way we can shift that money around. So because we're going to Medicare averages about 45%, we're getting closer to 50% of all the Medicare beneficiaries are on a value-based reimbursement plan, that Medicare Part C plan. Mm-hmm. And so it is important that we have coders out there that can look at the documentation, can right. pick the most specific, can work with providers to say, mm-hmm. you know, hey, you said this patient has diabetes with CKD, chronic kidney disease. What stage is it, right? Can you right. expand upon that? Give me some more information there. Because depending on the stage that they have, there might be extra reimbursement shifted over to take care of that patient. So that's why there's such a need there. And I see that Marketplace people that have purchased their insurance through Marketplace, they also work on HCCs. Your Medicaid managed care works on HCCs. We are transitioning into this more value-based type of world with ACOs in place. And so those HCC coders are going to be more and more and more in demand. So I say, embrace your diagnosis coding, my friends. Read your guidelines. Assign codes from the tabular.
So for someone who's newer to coding, this green professional, they're newly credentialed, they haven't had a coding job, what would you recommend to them to break into HCC coding? Because I feel like that's a perfect entry level job for a coder if they're seeking it. Obviously, they don't need to have this broad, you know, base of right. knowledge to do HCC coding. It is super, it's hyper-focused on only 10,000 codes. Right. So it's getting you into coding. It's getting you exposure to it. You're using your skills. So how would they go about getting into that and finding that type of job?
So I would look at the Medicare Part C payers that are out there. And you can go onto the Medicare website and start looking for your risk adjustment payers. Humana, United Healthcare, Cigna, some of the Blues, they all do that. And I would look specifically into their career opportunities and look for those HCC coding positions there. That's really where you're going to find your big break. Outside of the payer world, you want to look into your ACOs. You want to look into some of your larger primary care practices there. And they're always going to be looking for those HCC coders. Those are the ones that you're, again, you read the guidelines. You were like me when they came out in August. You were like, oh my gosh, I can't wait to sit down and read these guidelines and what has changed.
That wasn't me. No, not at all.
Oh, well, no. That's okay. You and I can bond on something else, I'm sure. reach out to those payers first that you know are already doing this and they're looking for it. They're looking for auditors. And they're also looking for coders that can go in and have a relationship with the providers and say, again, when you have a patient that has this diagnosis, you need to also document what you're doing for them. How are you managing it? How are you, treating this patient? And using those most specific codes, because it does matter. It matters how much they're putting over to care for that patient.
Yeah, definitely. Anything tied to value-based care, that's a significant change in healthcare. Talking about significant changes, value, that is the direction of the future. There's no getting away from it. That we're definitely being steered toward. And it's a good concept. It's something that we need to do. The healthcare system has a lot of issues, a lot of problems out there. And value-based care is one way of addressing those issues. Not that that's a perfect system either. There is no perfect system, but it's definitely a step in the right direction for sure.
And it incentivizes their providers to take better care of patients. So if there's that much money allocated to give that patient, and we do a really great job managing the patient where they don't have to have hospitalizations, they don't have to have additional services to, again, manage exacerbated conditions, then we are saving those healthcare dollars. And that is the key there.
Yeah, I think that kind of like seems like it is contrary to how healthcare has been in the past, the fee for service. You get paid based on the volume of services that you're rendering to a patient. So the sicker patients are getting more services and therefore you're getting more money. But if we flip that dynamic and we say, now you're going to get more money for keeping your patients healthy, that seems like a pretty darn good model, especially for patients. There are a lot of patients out there who are getting surgical procedures that are unnecessary just because you and I have had extensive conversations on that. Just because it brings in the dollars to these physicians for doing the procedures. You know, they're going to make what they make off an office visit, but you do a procedure, you're going to get a few thousand dollars or more off of a surgical procedure, you know, that you're doing on some of your patients there. That brings us to the end of part one of my interview with Christine Hall. Don't forget to mark your calendars for November 16th when part two of my interview with Christine drops. You definitely won't want to miss it as we discuss strategies on how to increase your salary. And as always, I want to say thank you to my loyal listeners. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please be sure to take a moment to give the podcast a 5-star rating. As always, if you have feedback you'd like to share on an episode or a topic suggestion for a future episode, please feel free to send an email to podcast@radrx.com. That's podcast@radrx.com. And I would still have to start an Ask Stacy segment, so please submit any questions you would like me to answer in a future episode to askstacy@radrx.com. That's Ask Stacy. That's Stacy, STACIE, @radrx.com. Thanks again for tuning in and have an amazing week.
Thank you for listening to Who Cares What Stacy Says? You can connect with Stacy on social media. You can find her business page for RadRx on Facebook, and you can connect with her personally on LinkedIn. Don't forget to check out the online training courses offered by RadRx: Cracking the IR Code, Mastering Interventional Radiology and Cardiology Online Training, or Cracking the Diagnostic Radiology Code Online Training. Thanks again for tuning in to Who Cares What Stacy Says? A podcast providing insights and advice on how to take your medical coding career to the next level.